So we are in our 16th class, believe it or not, on the study of miracles. We've looked at the Old Testament. We've been long in the New Testament now. And we are seeing then predominantly the miracles of the Lord Jesus Christ, though already He has sent the apostles out and they have been performing miracles. There is at least one other in an unusual statement we find that is also performing miracles at this time and with God's commendation and power, not faking it at all. But we have discovered that in our study of the miracles throughout history, they are really very rare and very few, particularly in the Old Testament, not many at all. There's a total of perhaps 50, but in the New Testament, there are 50 that Jesus does. And then, of course, the book of Acts lies ahead as well. So we have found in the study of these miracles that there is an obvious and profoundly important purpose for these miracles. They are designed by God to point at the messenger and the message that we might learn, because we have been drawn first by the eyewitnesses and now by the record of those eyewitnesses, drawn to the wisdom of the message because of the power that attends its presentation. So more of that again this morning. As I stated last week, we are going maybe a little bit faster now because we are seeing that these miracles fall into several general classes, types of miracles that are being repeated. And now that we have seen, for instance, the feeding of the 5,000, we look at the feeding of the 4,000 this time, no need to spend quite as much time on each of them. Each of the background slides, as always, I try to find some photograph of Israel itself. Would that they were building this house for me. Okay. This structure that you see under construction is a personal residence. There's some really nice homes, even by our standards, in Israel. You can tell they're going to have a cathedral ceiling and all of that. And this is in the region that Mark 7 is also in. The Golan Heights is a fairly large and extensive area that is on the eastern shores of the Sea of Galilee. And so here's this view of the Sea of Galilee. All of this right through there is the north shore where Jesus performed the vast majority of his miracles. And so Capernaum, I think, is on this little area right here, probably behind that stood, would be the likely location of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus has been going back and forth across this lake in order to preach these numerous sermons that he is presenting throughout the majority of his preaching career. Those 3.5 years is here, right in full view of where this house is now under construction. But we are, while that is the north shore, in fact, you can just barely see, this is the Jordan River coming into the Sea of Galilee right there. But this is the northern part of what would be called the Golan Heights. So the general area of Gamla, for those of you who were with me last time. Okay. Carl.
Capernaum is there.
Pardon me?
North shore is Capernaum, right?
Yeah, Capernaum is right in the middle there of the north shore. So it's either this little point here or that one. I can't tell in this particular photograph. That's Jesus' hometown and what he's using as the base then for all of this preaching and for all of these miracles. So the Golan Heights, as you can see, is an elevated plateau. Looks right down onto the Jordan and the Sea of Galilee there. But we want to look at Mark chapter 7 and verses 31, as you can see on the slide, through 37. Again, he went out from the region of Tyre. So we saw the miracle last week, that one with the Syrophoenician woman, and came through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee within the region of Decapolis. So I think you all know Deca is 10, Polis is city, the Decapolis is the region of the 10 cities. It's a Roman designation, a Roman area of the time. And this house would be sitting in the midst of those 10 cities somewhere as you look at the slide. So we're in the region of Decapolis and overlooking it, as you see in that particular photograph. So here comes Jesus out of the area that's now Lebanon, just to the north and on the coast. He's come back inland now and south here to this region. And in verse 32, they brought to him one who was deaf and spoke with difficulty. Of course, that's very common among those that are deaf to this day. they entreated him to lay his hand upon him. So by this point, and you can see in Mark 8, we're past the halfway point in Jesus' preaching and teaching. Jesus has worked apparently hundreds already of these miracles. Even though only 50 in total are recorded, we've had now, I think, 4 different times that we are told that many other miracles are also taking place at this time. So the people have come to expect what you see in verse 32. The common procedure is that Jesus would lay his hands upon the person who is being healed. It is not necessary. He has both raised from the dead and healed others from a distance where he wasn't even present. But if he's in the presence of the individual to be healed, most often he will make a physical contact with that individual. So they're begging him to do this. They have learned, it's been widespread knowledge from the woman we've already studied, if you sneak up behind him and just touch the hem of his garment, you can be healed. So you can imagine the frenzy that there is everywhere Jesus goes, people bringing from what are now huge distances, everybody with every imaginable malady to be healed. If we can just get to him and have him reach out and lay his hand upon him. So in 33, he took him aside, though, from the multitude by himself. This is an unusual thing. And he put his fingers into his ears. This has no other parallel. And after spitting, which we have had, and he made some clay and healed one of blindness, he spit and touched his tongue. Now, we don't have any more information, you know, precisely about this to help us understand what Jesus did. Did he spit on the end of one finger and then touch that finger and that spittle of the man's tongue? You know, why does he do this? We have no earthly idea. I don't know. The scripture doesn't tell us. We cannot know. And so when we see, you know, information like this, I guess we should be glad that God told us so that we can see as clearly as possible how this healing transpired. But we must be careful not to assign, you know, any kind of reasons or additional understandings about the practice, the thing Jesus did, because we're just not told. And so I have no further information on that. But he touched his tongue, and then in 34, looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to him, Ephphatha. Now, if you wanted to make a note, and we brought this up in the Daniel class, though Daniel is 500 years, you know, before this event, Aramaic has become the lingua franca of the time of Jesus and was already being spoken extensively because of the capture of the Jews, of the Babylonians, and subsequently the Medo-Persians. Aramaic has become the most popular, most used language, the most common language throughout this entire region, not just in Galilee. So Hebrew is spoken, but Aramaic is the more common of the languages. So Ephphatha is the Aramaic. Mark especially, you'll notice, I read one commentary this week, was pointing out, Mark especially likes to have an extremely vivid presentation of every event that takes place. Hence, we're not surprised that he tells us about Jesus spitting and then touching the man's tongue. There's just more detail there. Well, right down to the use of this word, ephphatha, we learn right there by his just recording that single word what language Jesus was using. And at that moment, what he said was, as again you can see at the end of verse 34, be opened. He is commanding the man's tongue and mouth to be freed so that he may speak fluently, with great articulation. He is given perfect speech with this single Aramaic word, which means be open. So Mark's kind of fun that way in seeing how he draws us down into that event with specifics that you do not find in the other writers. In fact, in this case, you have 3 gospel writers, John not, but the other two, who also tell us about this event. So, Jesus is also, in verse 34, looking up to heaven, and then he sighed. He is under such duress, so many people. And he does care about these people. But he's also, you know, tired. And so is it just an expression of love? Is it an expression, you know, just, you know, kind of summoning strength like we do, you know, when you're really busy and tired? You know, I don't know. There's this looking up into heaven, this heavy sigh, ephatha, and the man is here. I'm sorry, I didn't see you waving your hand, but they're probably got it up the rest of the audience.
Early in his ministry, he was performing these miracles to prove who he was. There's no doubt about that. But as he progresses into his ministry, you think he's still doing that? Because I mean, here he's withdrawing from the crowd. And, I know we said he didn't do it just to be nice, but here, you know, it's starting to look like he is just doing it just to be nice.
Okay, you couldn't pick that up on the recording. Greg is saying, you know, I have been emphasizing throughout that Jesus does not perform these miracles just because of compassion, just because he's nice. But in this case, he takes the man aside. Who else is going to be seeing this, you know, except this one man? And so Greg is asking, you know, well, you know, this one especially, it sounds like it's just really, you know, a very personal kind of a thing. And that's right. I think your actual question was, you know, do I still think in this case that really, you know, the focus there is not just purely compassion or exclusively compassion, but, you know, for the sake of the miracle itself and how extensive it would be known. I think particularly in this one, you know, we still have that exact same thing going on. It seems to be more likely that if this individual, well, let me put it this way. Where did Jesus just come from? Tyre and Sidon. It's the one trip where he was not performing these miracles in Galilee. When he goes up into Tyre and Sidon, while we're not told, but when a miracle takes place up there, it's for the same purpose. Would anybody other than the woman who begs for this healing and gets the crumbs from the table, would anybody else in that region have heard about this? Okay, and sure they would. And when Jesus comes back down into this territory, the coast is in the far distance. You can't see it. It's on the other side. Tyre and Sidon are up here, but they're not all that far away. So when he comes back down out of Tyre and Sidon and he comes into this region, what do you just suppose might have happened? Followed him in multitudes. There's a whole brand new audience that he's introduced to these miracles up there that he just did. Okay. What language did he use? Aramaic. That's the language of all the peoples. Is it the Hebrew's native tongue? No. So he does. He takes the guy aside, and there's more to this story. Watch what happens next. But, you know, I have no doubt he's still doing exactly the same thing, and he may be doing it with someone now who's coming out of that region. What it says is, his ears were open, the impediment of his tongue was removed, he began speaking plainly, and in 36 he gave them orders not to tell anyone. Look, you just gave the guy the gift of speech, apparently for the first time in his life, and what's the first thing you tell him? Be quiet. How well does this work? Verse 36, the more widely they continued to what? To proclaim it. They were utterly astonished, saying, he's done all things well. He makes even the deaf to hear and the dumb to speak. Okay, so how private is this event when all is said and done? This is just not at all. Okay, now, by the way, tell no one. Okay, does that mean you have to go through the rest of your life dumb? You can't speak? No. So we've seen this several times before, at least twice before. The command is given. Don't tell anybody. But when that command is given, is it given to everybody in the region or just to that individual? That individual. On other occasions, he'll say, go and tell everybody. So it's apparent that this has something to do then with the nature of the individual or the nature of the circumstances where either this person is not very well qualified to be representing Jesus, or on this occasion Jesus has other reasons why, perhaps because he's going to be flooded and won't be able to work if too many people come, you know, that he doesn't want anybody to say anything about it. These are great questions. I'm glad that Greg brought it up because, you know, it's hard to understand. Why does over here he say, don't tell anybody? Over here he says, do tell people. You know, what's going on there? Again, this has to be based in the immediate circumstances that are not recorded for us. I don't know. But does this remain a private event that nobody knows about? No. And when Jesus did it, what language is he using? The Aramaic. Where did he just come from? A predominantly Aramaic-speaking people. Wherefore, the Jews, this might be a second language. Aramaic is the first language for the Sidonians and the Tyrians. So, wish I had more on that. You really don't, but it is. There's more curiosities to add. Yes?
Did you say that he commanded
them
not to tell everyone, or
them? Well, it says them in 36. It's plural. He gave them orders not to tell anyone, but the more he ordered them, the more widely they continued to proclaim it. So looking at verse 33, he took him aside from the multitude by himself, put his fingers into his ears, spitting, touched his tongue, looking up to heaven, deep sigh, said to him, be open. Ears were open, impediment of his tongue removed. He began speaking plainly, and he gave them orders not to tell anyone. So again, you know, the good Bible students paying close attention to there. Thank you. The command is to the group after he took the guy apart privately. So what do you know? Well, apparently nobody was there for the actual healing. Somehow he took him aside and it was private. Who knew about it? Everybody. And then Jesus told them not to tell anybody. Yeah, that's right. See, so again, I don't know. I can't comprehend it. I don't know why he took that guy apart. But as soon as he comes back, what's everybody know? Now he speaks. Now he hears. You know. And so then this command goes out, as Vicky's pointed out, to some group of them. Is it his family? Is that all the extent of the them? Is it just the people that he came out from behind the trees, you know, and there were 15 or 20, you know, who were family and friends and strangers? Is it thousands of people? He stands on a big rock now. He says, hey, I don't want anybody to say anything about this man I just healed, okay? After which they all promptly went out and told everybody. So you can't restrain it. So I wish I knew, brother. I really did. It's just one of those oddities, and I can't answer it. There was a reason Jesus did it, and we're not told. So at any rate, that's what happens, and they're marveling everywhere in verse 37. So there's the conclusion of this miracle in the region that is also a predominantly what? Jew or Gentile region. It's the Decapolis. It's predominantly a Roman, therefore Gentile area where this took place. So, I don't know. Maybe he's just trying to prevent, you know, too many Gentiles interrupting the program here. And so, speculation is all I can say. All right, in the next background slide right here, and we'll be looking, as you can see at Mark, the first 13 verses of the next chapter, chapter 8. BiblePlaces.com is a marvelous website, BiblePlaces.com. The individual that is behind that, Todd Bolin, has spent many years living and teaching in Israel. This is one of his creations right there. And I particularly like this one just because he did a good job of identifying, you know, these various regions. We had a miracle last week where Jesus crossed over from this immediate region of Noph, Gennesar, to, that's not north of Gennesar, by the way. Noph is the Hebrew term. not Gennesaret, the name of the location. But anyway, they're going back and forth. It's about 7 miles across the Sea of Galilee from right here. Tabgha is a suggested location for the feeding of the 5,000. I suggested that it might have been just out of sight right here at the bottom of the picture when we talked about it last week, but we really just don't know. This is the general region of that, well, this is all that north shore we were just talking about, and as it comes around the corner there, Magdala's is just like right there, immediately out of the picture, Mary Magdalene. Here's your Mount of Beatitudes over there. So in Mark chapter 8, we're back into this immediate region as come back down off the Golan Heights, which would be kind of like right here if the picture was expanded. And now he's just come down into this region, Mark 8:1. In those days, again, when there was a great multitude and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples and said to them, I feel compassion for the multitude because they've remained with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them away hungry to their home, they will faint on the way. Some of them have gone, have come from a distance. And his disciples answered him, where will anyone be able to find enough to satisfy these men with bread here in a desolate place? And he was asking them, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7. He directed the multitude to sit down on the ground, taking the 7 loaves. He gave thanks and broke them, started giving them to his disciples to serve to them. They served them to the multitude. They also had a few small fish. After he had blessed them, he ordered these to be served as well. And they ate and were satisfied. They picked up 7 baskets full of what was left over of the broken pieces, and about 4,000 were there, and he sent them away. Immediately, he entered the boat with his disciples and came to the district of Dalmanutha. We don't know where Dalmanutha is, but in the parallel of Matthew chapter 15, we're told that he is close to Magdala or Magadan, Migdal. All these places, depending on the language or the time frame of when you're talking, will have more than one name. I am a big Adrian Monk fan. Who knows who Adrian Monk is? Okay. 8 years, you know, the defective detective, was doing his TV show, played by Tony Shalhoub. The one I just happened to watch yesterday was, you know, him going to New York City. And when he went to New York City, the cops there kept talking about Frisco. Well, you know, Cap Stottlemyre was there as well. Stottlemyre got real upset about it. He said, it's not Frisco, it is San Francisco. Now, who's right? And who's wrong? What do you have? 2 different designations. And if you just see SF, what is it as opposed to LA? Okay, there are all these different designations. So Magadan, Migdal, Magdala, even Dalmanutha here, you know, we don't know. And Dalmanutha may be a totally very different name, you know, for exactly the same city, again, ordinarily we would call Magdala, I think, in our language. So I don't know where it is. But he's somewhere here in this immediate area. In this region right here to this bend, you can see how very flat it is. This is more hilly. You know, this is your plain of Gennesaret. Today, they call it Naf Gennesar. It's the location of a Jewish kibbutz. We stayed there this last year as well for a couple of days. But Gennesar is the current Israeli term for Gennesaret. I don't know exactly where these places were, and I know the names can be very confusing, but it's a real small territory. We know, it's right in this immediate vicinity. So what happens? The same thing that had just happened there within a couple of months ago. Now he feeds 4,000. Last time he fed 5,000. This one also designates men like the first one did, not counting the women and the children. It's a much larger number than the 5 or the 4. Now, how come the disciples don't know how to handle this? They've already been through it once before. So everybody in unison. I don't know. I don't know. what's going on there? If they were just, you know, trying to confirm it, or, you know, what's going on? You know, I don't know. But I don't want to spend a lot of time on this one. We've already done this with even bigger numbers. So not only are healings being repeated of every kind of disease, lots of people will have the same disease. He can always heal that disease and the other disease and the next disease and every other problem. And now he's feeding people who this time have been with him for 3 days and growing weak. It's getting dangerous. They're going to start going down. People are going to have to start carrying him on litters. You know, this is a major problem. Well, Jesus feeds them. Immediately entered the boat with his disciples, came to the district of Dalmanutha. Now, when he enters the boat, you read, Jesus entered the boat, and then he went somewhere else. Every time he gets on the boat, does he have to go the whole 7 miles to the furthest distant opposite shore? No. What really is the easiest way to go, even if you just want to go a mile? Get in the boat and go a mile. Get out of the boat. It's going to be, especially if you got 12 guys rowing, you know, get up lickety split. So rather than walking, you know, through the trees and hill and dale, just get in the boat. So again, we don't know how far it was, but he took a boat. The boat is their local taxi, and it is being used a lot. So he then comes to Dalmanutha. Now, I didn't want to read the next couple of verses, 11 through 13. Pharisees came out, began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him, and sighing deeply in his spirit. Now, this does sound like frustration and disappointment. How many times have we been through this by now? Sighing deeply in his spirit, he said, "Why does this generation seek for a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation." And leaving them, he again embarked and went over to the other side. Now, the other side doesn't have to be 7 miles away, other side. It could be the other side over here. It could be the other side over there. You know, all these different ones. But when these guys come, Jesus is obviously frustrated. And this time he says, no miracles for you. But who's the you in this last three verses? A Pharisee who came to test him. Have they an open heart? Is there any number of miracles that's going to change their mind? Is there any kind of miracle that's going to change their mind? We will see next week in what will likely be a single class on one, quote, parable in the evening. Next week in the evening, we'll probably spend all of our time looking at one parable that's going on right there. But what we're looking at, in the context, is Jesus trying to teach people who often are what? Really hard-hearted. And in that place, Jesus will say, they won't believe, those five brothers of the guy, you know, that has died and is now in torment, they wouldn't believe even if somebody raises from the dead. Because he'd ask that Lazarus be sent to his five brothers. They won't believe even if somebody rises from the dead. And how would Jesus know this beyond being omniscient? Because he has raised people from the dead. And they're still, you know, hardened hearts. So, when he says no miracle, with Nazareth, for instance, as again we saw last week, or with these people, it's not that he can't, it is that he won't. And he sighs deeply, because does Jesus love Mary from Magdala and hate the Pharisees? Loves the Pharisees too, doesn't he? They're not nearly so lovable. But is he going to die on that cross for Mary and not for the Pharisees? He's going to die for them all. And especially when you see a really hard heart. It just breaks your heart. What do I have to do? What am I to do? I have to tell you, brother, that, you know, and I've told you before, I am truly astonished at Eugene's homeless problem. I've never seen anything like this before. And I find myself sometimes sighing. Because
the endless need that we see here, trying to weed out people that are sincere from those that aren't. This is an ever-present problem, in this community, and more so than most. In fact, I happened to have a friend of mine tell me he had just seen it on the national news one day last week that Eugene had, in the nation, one of the worst homeless problems anywhere. We're right at the top, and it was on national news how bad it is where we live. So you do. You get tired. You get frustrated. Nothing, ever seems to work. And Jesus is in this same condition. But never suggest that, or conclude that the only way he can work a miracle is if the individual shows enough faith. He's trying to produce faith. He is not going to throw miracles at people who wouldn't believe if you raised their brother from the dead. He's not going to do that. But he is going to continue to work these miracles for everyone who has an open heart. So, enough on that one. We've seen him do that before. It's the same event. The first time that I chartered a private aircraft to fly over Israel was in 2011 with Farrell Jenkins. This is one of Farrell's photographs. And, really fun when now you're in control and you get to go wherever you want and take pictures of whatever you like. But this is a highly unusual picture. I've looked all over the internet, don't see anything really quite like this. Farrell knew what he was doing. He was directing the pilot. But here is the Jordan River. And as the Jordan River comes down right to the very bottom land, you can see now it's quite convoluted coming through here. And then it fans out into this huge kind of swampland right there. And you can see it turns like this, and there's a main flow right there, but it also splits and comes in over here. It looks like we've got another little channel right in there, so there's kind of a big delta area right there. So where before we were looking at the plain of Gennesaret, and you were having Capernaum and the location for the Sermon on the Mount identified in that previous picture. Okay, here is Magdala looking that way. The plain is up here now over the Jordan Valley looking back this way. And the Jordan itself is coming in. It's probably just outside the picture right over here. But here's where that kind of swampland begins. That you can see here as we're getting ready to turn to Mark chapter 8, verses 22 through 26. It's thought that one location, a likely location for the several Bethsaidas that you read about in the New Testament, would have been right in this general region right here. So we'll be reading about Bethsaida, I think, in a minute again. But here's your 7 miles across the whole north shore that you can see now of your Sea of Galilee. It's 13 miles down to the far end there, a pretty big body of water. Now we're picking up the reading in Mark 8 and verse 22 through 26. So I've got a little shorty right here. But in 8:22, they came to Bethsaida. So somewhere, we think in this region right here, some ruins have been found. There are some questions, not as sure on this occasion, but somewhere in this area. And they brought a blind man to him and entreated him to touch him. Have we healed blind people before? Many. Taking a blind man by the hand, he brought him out of the village, and after spitting on his eyes and laying his hands upon him, he asked him, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see men, for I am seeing them like trees walking about." Then again he laid his hands upon his eyes, and he looked intently, the man did, and was restored and began to see everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, "Do not even enter the village." Now, everybody, the single word, big question, all in unison, 3 letters, like one letter of the alphabet. Why? And the answer is, I don't know. And again, this is so unusual. Now you're really seeing it today. Mark gives you details that the other writers don't tell you about. He draws you deeply into this event. Unhappily, now, today, it's also somewhat confusing for us. What's the deal with the spit? I don't know. And this miracle, really, above all others, particularly confuses me. How many times have I said, Jesus always heals completely, entirely, immediately, at that time. This would be, you know, as far as an argument goes, the one place, though, where what? Really isn't quite instantaneous, is it? Did Jesus fail partially and have to take a second run at his miracle? Should this suggest to you that maybe there is some trickery, you know, going on? So he now had to kind of regroup, and, you know, he kind of got caught. All of these kinds of suggestions people will, you know, throw at the Lord. And it's not the case at all. But why? I don't know. Did the man see? Yes, but not with perfect clarity. People, he said, I see men, but they look like what? Trees. So apparently, you know, without as much detail. And so I couldn't distinguish the arms. It just looked like, you know, a tree trunk. But they're moving, you know, walking about. So a second then contact from Jesus takes place, and then the man sees perfectly. Okay, it is a complete, immediate, on that occasion, healing. It's not really an exception. But there are two stages, and God doesn't want us to know why. Always, I think, best to look at it that way. God did not want us to know why. Because there's only one way we can know. That is if one of these authors tells us. If Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't tell us, then the Holy Spirit has not revealed or has else forbidden the revelation of this material. The answer to our question is not given to Matthew. It isn't given to Mark. It isn't given to Luke. John doesn't even record the event. So we will forever be left wondering why. That the bigger question might be, why didn't God want me to know? You know, why aren't we told? I don't know. So, you know, for me though, it is also an actual confirmation of how very honest that the Bible writers are. If you were going to set out to try to show that Jesus always entirely, immediately, completely heals, you know, each and every time, would you tell about this second phase of this healing? No, you wouldn't. So if you do tell about this second phase, then certainly God knows, as does the writers, questions will be raised. There's an avenue for unbelievers and hostile people to try to make an argument. And yet, there's the record. See, it's not covered over. It must not then be a failure, a problem. You know, it just is different. Based apparently on circumstances of that moment that are of such a unique nature, God chooses not to tell us. He does not want us to know. Likely some other problem would have arisen if we had known, maybe more grist, you know, for enemies or whatever. I can't tell you. I wish I did, but Lee has it right now.
Deuteronomy 29:29.
The secret things belong to our God, and things that have been revealed, you know, to us. So we don't have any more. So somewhere in this general region, we have what is the only kind of two-step healing that takes place, and I don't know why. The last miracle we want to contemplate here for the next 4 minutes takes place somewhere, perhaps in this region, but it's the event that's right after what we call the Transfiguration. Jesus had gone up onto a mountain for the Transfiguration. And the next event takes place, apparently, on that mountain or in the region of that mountain. This is the top, an aerial photograph of Mount Tabor in a Catholic monastery-type facility up there. That's Mount Tabor. I got up on it the first time just this last year, you know, with Emma and Susan. And so we stood on this courtyard right here and elevated up some stairs and right in that corner and took some photographs.
But I wanted them particularly to see this photograph. We had a very windy and foggy kind of a day. And so remember when we stood up there, everyone was wondering, did you think it was anywhere near this pretty? It's just gorgeous. We didn't get to see it because of the dusty, you know, kind of a foggy day. But this is Mount Tabor, possibly where this event took place. The other possibility would be to the far north, and that would be at Mount Hermon, where Caesarea Philippi is, gates of Hades. And there at Caesarea Philippi, who do men say that I am, you know, is the foot of Mount Hermon. And so Jesus had gone from there to the event of the Transfiguration. So did he go up that mountain, Mount Hermon, or did he come down here and go up this mountain where the next event places him? And so we just don't know. The background is one of the two possibilities, still in Galilee in the plain of Jezreel that lies at your feet there. That's a little bit longer one, but it doesn't take a lot of time really again. In verse 14 of chapter 9, they came back to the disciples. They saw a large crowd around them, scribes arguing. Immediately, when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed, began rounding up to greet him. He asked them, "What are you discussing with them?" One of the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son, possessed with a spirit which makes him mute." Now, if you keep in count, in Mark's Gospel, this is number 10 of the 13 times that demons are cast out. So this is number 10. "Whenever it seizes him, it dashes him, he foams and grinds his teeth, stiffens out. I told your disciples, cast it out. They could not. He answered them and said, Oh, unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me." Now clearly, Jesus is annoyed on this occasion. They're failing him, and it angers him. "They brought the boy to him. When he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into a convulsion, falling to the ground, rolling about, foaming. He asked his father, How long has this been happening to him? And he said, From childhood, and it has often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us. And Jesus said to him," and perhaps explaining why he is unhappy with the unbelieving generation, "If you can, all things are possible to him who believes." Immediately the boy's father cried out, saying, "I do believe. Help my unbelief." And when Jesus saw the crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying, "You deaf and dumb spirit," we just had a healing of a deaf and dumb man earlier, "I command you, come out of him, do not enter him again." After crying out, throwing him into terrible convulsions, it came out. Boy became so much like a corpse that most said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and raised him, and he got up. When he had come into the house, his disciples questioned him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot come out by anything but prayer." I don't know how many kinds of demons there are, what is the difference between the varying kinds, how prayer would play into this, but apparently, because the disciples had attempted and failed, it was due to their not properly praying first. They should. It's always like a dance when that bell starts. They didn't. Pardon me?
Fasting also.
And fasting in the other location. That's right. We have parallel passage. By prayer and fasting. The disciples failed. The whole community is failing. But Jesus does healing. And apparently, and perhaps at least, without the prayer or the fasting, he does it instantly. There's no time for a fast. So did he pray? You know, I'm not sure, but they should have, even if Jesus didn't have to. There are worse kinds. This is one of the worst kinds, and the disciples failed. Not Jesus. Okay, you heard the bell. Class is moving.